right. Well, hey, Randy, what's going on?
How's it going, Jim?
I was just thinking that we might talk about time crystals today. What do you know about time crystals?
Well, that sounds like a great idea. This has been a really exciting area of research over the last few years, and it's been dramatic. It's had its ups and downs. There's been a lot of controversy, and in hardly any time at all, it's gone from being a theoretical construct to being an experimental reality. I guess we should mention where it all started with Nobel laureate Frank Wilczek.
Okay, and he had this idea, what, in 2012, I guess?
That's right. Yeah, he'd been teaching a class and he'd been thinking about it for a couple of years, and he finally published something in 2012. Well, let me tell you a little bit about Frank Wilczek. I mean, he's one of my favorite theoretical physicists. He got the Nobel Prize for his work on asymptotic freedom in the quantum chromodynamics theory, which is fascinating, and that's probably a subject that should be fun to talk about. He also wrote one of my favorite articles called The Origin of Mass, and I'll send you the link to that so we can include that in the show notes. And that was a really interesting article. So, you know, he's a man of many talents. He's one of the true greats in the physics community. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this idea that he had and he published in 2012?
Well, he had this idea about symmetry. So if you look at, say, a crystal lattice, the space for that doesn't have anything.
They say that it breaks spatial symmetry.
Yeah, so the laws of nature are spatially symmetric. There's a translational symmetry. So it doesn't matter where you are in the universe. All of the laws of nature are the same. And because of that, you have like conservation of momentum and things like that. What happens in a crystal is that because of all the atoms sitting around in the crystal, if you have something that's moving along in that crystal, like an electron or something like that, its wave functions have to sort of mirror the symmetry of the crystal. And that symmetry is no longer spatially homogeneous, right? You don't have this translational symmetry where you can go everywhere and everything's exactly the same. Now you have to mirror the symmetries of the crystal. And if you have a perfect crystal, for example, that would mean that every lattice spacing, you have exactly the same situation. So now you have to move one lattice or two lattice spacings or three lattice spacings apart to get back to the exact same situation. So in that sense, you've broken the symmetry so that you no longer can just move around at will and have the exact same things happening to this electron. Now it has to go to a specific spot in that crystal that mirrors the same energy conditions that it would have previously based on the location of nearby atoms and so forth and so on. What Wilczek's idea was that there's nothing really special about time where this should also be true. So why can't you make a time crystal such that because it's periodic in time, you have to have a wave function that itself is periodic in time, and therefore you have some interesting properties because of that. I'm not really sure what those interesting properties are supposed to be, but you end up with some interesting properties because of that symmetry breaking in time. So you get a periodicity in that wave function in time. I mean, you can think about it just like a sine wave or something like that that you're looking at on an oscilloscope. You know, the wave function has to oscillate at a specific period, and that period has to match whatever the periodicity of that crystal is. In this case, it's in time.
It's kind of fascinating to think about it in just purely visual terms. As he was talking about a crystal which would change shape and then return to its original shape over and over and over again indefinitely.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it, is that something's physically changing in that crystal periodically.
Right, and apparently there's a lot of different properties within a time crystal that can do this, but the idea is that at specific intervals, it is in the same state that it started in, and it just keeps repeating this indefinitely. And it's in that way, it resembled like a perpetual motion device. Like here it is something that's moving that continually goes on forever and ever. That was sort of his idea. It's kind of fascinating because he figured all of this out just thinking about it. And now they're saying that it's a new state of matter that we've never seen before. So his idea got out there, and there were some articles in the popular press, and there were some arguments on both sides. I think Sean Carroll came out and said that he believed that it was a sound idea and that it was probably something we could realize in the lab. And then there were some other scientists which came out a couple of years later and argued that his original idea, that these time crystals could exist in a ground state, that wasn't actually possible. And so it took a turn, but subsequent work developed and said, okay, well, time crystals might not be feasible in a ground state or in a thermal equilibrium state. So they can't be like just at rest, changing shape or doing whatever it is that they're doing cyclically indefinitely, but they can exist in a non-equilibrium state and have this property of returning to this configuration over and over again.
So yeah, I mean, it was basically shown by Wanatabe and Oshikawa that you can't have a true time crystal, something that's just existing out there independent of some external driving force. But people decided to take it to the next sort of idea, right? This Yao decided that maybe if you use a periodic driving function of some kind, you can actually create something that's somewhat like a time crystal. And so it's got everything you'd want from a time crystal, but it's missing the whole idea that it can exist independently of what you're doing in the laboratory. Right.
I kind of loved the idea that you could have this object, you know, going through a deformation or a series of deformations indefinitely on your desk. You know, that'd be pretty cool. So they had to throw that idea, I think, out the window. But this is where they came across the idea of this new state of matter, is they realized, oh, well, if we have this ensemble of particles that's in a non-equilibrium state indefinitely, then there's like new physics available there, and they can do this kind of thing at room temperature, it turns out. So in a way, it's like one of the few quantum states that you can experiment without getting into the super cold regimes.
Okay, now I'm confused. You're saying that both of these papers where they created these things were done at room temperature?
No, I don't think it was both of them. I think that it was just the one at Harvard. In 2016, Norman Yao, I love that name, Yao, Norman Yao had created the edifice for taking this idea from the theoretical realm and realizing it in the laboratory. And so two teams, one at Harvard and one at the University of Maryland, proceeded to design an experiment and see if they could detect the signature of a time crystal. And I think it was the Harvard experiment that used a kind of diamond. And those experiments were conducted at room temperature. But I think that the other experiments that were done with ytterbium, I think those might have been cooled.
Those almost certainly were. I mean, they were trapped ytterbium ions. I think if you're doing those atom traps, it's kind of chilly.
Okay, you got to keep them cold so they'll stay put, huh?
That's my belief. At Harvard, that was done by Lucan. We talked about something from Lucan earlier. He was one of the guys with the photonic atoms.
Oh, okay.
You know, I didn't see anything in here saying that it was at a very cold temperature, but I thought that was a ultra-cold lab, but I don't see anything in the paper that says that it was done at low temperatures. So yeah, I mean, to me, the Lucan paper is a little easier to understand than the other one, basically because he's using microwaves and the other one is using optics. In optics, they have all sorts of interesting things that I know nothing about. So yeah, they have these two different ways of doing it, one with an atom trap and one with diamond, and they have different ways of driving, for example. And that's actually great because they end up with very similar results, even though they have such different ways of forcing these things to occur.
Yeah, and it just so happens, I think, that they got published like the same month in like March of this year, 2017. So you can compare them side by side and see the same kind of signal patterns that they're reading from their experiments.
Yeah, you sent me these archive papers. Do you know where they were published? Were they both published in Science or something like that?
I think they were both published in Nature.
So I probably should have picked up my issue instead of just leaving it on the floor. That's what happens when you work too much. Sometimes they do that when they have two really hot heating things that seem like they should both go together. They'll publish them both at the same time. It's Nature, I think they only publish it once a month, so that's a reasonable thing to do, I think. So you had some questions about this.
Yeah, the papers are pretty complicated for my eye. A lot of them are dealing with exotic optical and quantum properties, and they're very technical papers. I mean, you're dealing with, you know, the work that was envisioned by a Nobel laureate and published in 2012, and then you've got some of the brightest minds in the world in experimental physics and theoretical physics doing the experiments to test the idea out. So this is really, I think, some of the most advanced and cutting-edge kind of research that you'll see, and it's fascinating to read, but also can be difficult to understand. It looks like what they're doing is they have an initiation process where they go through a few steps to prepare the sample and get it into the conditions they want it, and then they expose it to a driving frequency, which is a series of these preparations. They use maybe a magnetic field, and then they use a laser along one axis, and then they use a laser at a different axis, and then they cycle this again and again to get them in a repeating pattern that they need. And then, I'm not sure if I understand this properly, at that point, do they turn off their driving signal and observe as the configuration goes through its cycles and returns to its original state over and over again. I wasn't sure if they were driving it the whole time or not.
Yeah, I mean, at least in one of these, it shows exactly that. I think in the optical one, they had enough detail on that to make it clear. Actually, it was fairly clear what they were doing in the other one as well. It was clear in the text of the Lucan paper to me that they were doing that. With the discrete time crystal one, the observation of a discrete time crystal, that one I had to look in the supplementary material so that it made sense. But what they'll do is, in that particular case, they'll go through 101 of these periodic forcings, and then they'll let it relax for 1 millisecond. So they'll observe it during that 1 millisecond relaxation. Really, they only get to about 100 microseconds, I think, in their decay. It might be less. It's labeled 100. It could be 100 nanoseconds, for all I know, because I don't see here. I see the trace, but it just says time T. Maybe that's oscillations or something.
If you go to the next page, it looks like they've got it in nanoseconds and on the x-axis, and then there, it looks like they've got it in microseconds on the y-axis.
What page?
If you go to the very next page, page 3 of that Lucan paper, there's some more charts.
No, I was talking about the Monroe paper. Lucan, it was pretty obvious to me what was going on, although I think we ought to talk a little bit more about that. But yeah, in the Lucan paper, it was pretty obvious to me that after the evolution, however many times they did the readout, and that's because it's on page 2, it has a nice thing there. So Lucan was perfectly clear to me what was going on. It was the Monroe paper that I was talking about with the time. That T might be the number of periods, but that doesn't make it very useful when they're just letting it flow later on. And in this case, I'm looking at the supplemental material, but you know, nowhere in the descriptions does it actually say anything like that. Anyways, that's basically what happens, is to create one of these time crystals, you need this varying Hamiltonian, this varying interaction. And that varying interaction has to happen several times. I don't really recall from the Wilczek paper. I think from the Wilczek paper, that Hamiltonian was probably not something driven like this. In fact, his Hamiltonian was not the Floquet Hamiltonian that shows up in the Yao paper. His Hamiltonian was just two terms based on, one, the magnetic flux through a ring where a charged particle was trapped, and a interaction term between all of the different charged particles in the lattice. One of the things that Yao did when he said, what we're going to do is we're going to break the Hamiltonian down into several different components. We're going to cycle through those components. His original one was two components, and Monroe did three. But Yao's original interaction started with a pulse, so you have an interaction with a pulse for some time T1. And then for some time T2, you allow both the dipole-dipole interactions between nearest neighbors. So Yao's Hamiltonian was only using nearest neighbor atoms, looking at magnetic dipole moment interaction between those nearest neighbors, and then some random disorder term that acted on each one of those neighbors that was sort of knocking them around a little bit.
That's kind of confusing, because you'd think that a disorder term would make it go out of sync, but apparently this is intrinsic to the system.
What you're going to be doing with this is you're going to be continuously hitting this thing, pinging it with this energy, with this periodic driving force. And if you don't have that random disorder in there, then you're just going to keep adding more and more energy into that cycle.
Oh, and that's why it would heat up. So it needs to have disorder to not heat up and become thermalized. Is that it?
That's right.
Oh, okay. That makes sense now. I wish I could have explained it that simply in the paper. If they use really fancy language, that's sometimes difficult to follow.
Fortunately, I was able to get through all of these early this week and go through the popular stuff again. And it is actually in that popular article you sent me, what the whole purpose of that was.
Should have gone back and read that again.
And Monroe, when he puts his thing together with the optical stuff, he's trying to follow Yao as explicitly as possible. Now, he's taken a bunch of these ytterbium atoms, put them in these ultra-cold traps, and put them in these little atom traps, and they're sitting there being atomy. And then he breaks his pulse into three different parts. He's got one where he is trying to switch all of them at once, using polarized light, I think. So he's just trying to switch them all at once in sort of this Y direction, let's say. And then he switches what the laser is doing. And then for a little while more, he has them in this system where the atomic dipoles are all that's interacting. In this case, he's got them interacting in the X direction. And then he's got this AC Stark effect that he can throw at them, where he can actually program a random disorder into these strings of atoms. And so he programs his own disorder into these atom traps to make it work. That itself is very interesting, is that he can throw in the randomness the way he wants that randomness in that last case. But this is almost exactly Yao's procedure, only he's broken up the second part of Yao's procedure into two separate steps. Now, that's not surprising, because Yao is listed on the Monroe paper. So Yao was working very closely with Monroe in this.
I think, yeah, he worked with both teams, or at least they both relied heavily on his work.
I guess he is on the other paper as well. That's strange, because there's a note in the Lucan paper that says the authors were unaware of this other work while they...
Yeah, I remember reading that. I guess that they had only consulted him on the math, or maybe they had just taken his paper and run with it, and that's why they cited on their authors list.
That is the one where they went through and they said exactly what each person did. They conducted theoretical analysis, okay, whatever that means. So that's pretty interesting, but the Lucan paper didn't follow as closely to Yao's prescription as the Monroe paper did. The Monroe paper is almost exactly what Yao was giving as a roadmap to creating one of these time crystals with a periodic driving force.
Yeah, it looks like the MIT-Harvard team had a much larger group. And maybe that's how they were able to figure out this more complex macroscopic version of the experiment using Diamond.
Well, I think they just had this idea that if it would work, it should work in this thing that we already have sitting around.
Oh,
I shouldn't say that, but I assume they already had some Diamond with nitrogen vacancies available. So then they said, okay, well, how can we set up this same experiment? You know, when I was reading some of the earlier papers, I kept thinking to myself, you know, this sounds like spin echoes. How is this different from spin echoes? Spin echoes are a normal part of nuclear magnetic resonance. It's actually something they use in MRIs, I believe. It's something that people use all the time. It's fun. It's actually interesting because, let me see if I can remember the guy's name. It's interesting because the system is supposedly very near a time-reversible state. There aren't very many of those in thermodynamically sized systems, but I think Pines identified that as a place where you could get to this time reversal. Yeah, and that's David Pines, who used to be at UIUC, I believe. So I read something about that a long time ago. I think it was even in graduate school, because I remember a conversation with somebody when I was touring his lab, when I still got to do things like that.
Sounds like fun.
So anyways, I was thinking, well, how is this different? Both because spin echoes are supposed to be close to that, and, you know, I'd read that popular article, and then I was reading Wilczek's article, and it just sounded like spin echoes to me. And Yao actually talks about why it's different from spin echoes in his paper, and that is the spin echoes are basically at an unstable equilibrium. So with spin echoes, what you do is you take these pulses, right? You take this pulse, you align everything, and then you wait for a period, and you do another pulse and align them again. And basically what you're doing is you're filtering out all of the other frequencies by doing multiple pulses. And then you stop doing that and you observe what happens afterwards, and for a few times you get these pulses again. But apparently that steady state is unstable and it very quickly damps down.
Yeah, and this one was, and this is unusual because I think I read in here that it went through like 60 different cycles where it would go back to its original configuration.
Yeah, so they still have this disorder, right? They can't really turn off the disorder, I don't think. And so when they do this in this real crystal, even though they've set up everything very well and they get this interesting state, it still damps out. And you can see it very clearly in all of the data, the damping out. I mean, it starts high, goes low, and then they have to do some Fourier analysis tricks to show you the peaks and things like that. But you can see that you're losing energy after you've stopped hitting it with these Floquet cycles.
So that raises a question, because they're talking about using this concept. Is it at least something in the quantum non-equilibrium state that has a time crystal property? They're talking about using this to make like perfect memory for computers. At a theoretical level, are they saying that if they engineer the matter more precisely, that they'll be able to preserve information indefinitely?
I don't think so. I think the problem is this goes back to our definition of a time crystal, right? If you had something like Wilczek's original idea, you could probably do that. But instead, you need these periodically driven situations. And as they're periodically driven, they're fine. But as soon as you turn them off, you turn off that driving force, the energy can come out of the system. And as soon as the energy comes out, you can't keep the things going on forever. So it's unlikely that you can use this as a permanent memory. I don't think you can use it as something like MRAM or a hard drive or something like that, or flash. But you should be able to use it like the memory in your computer, the memory that's on when your computer is on and disappears when it's off.
So like a temporary memory where you actively keep it stored in the circuit by using that driving signal to compensate for the disorder that's constantly draining the signal?
And what they'd want to do is they'd want to be able to do this for a quantum computer. They don't want to do this for your computer. They'd want to do this for a quantum computer so that they could save a qubit state and then maybe do something with it whenever they want to do it later on, a few nanoseconds later, and be sure that it's still in the same state. It's not really exciting that they can build memory, but if you can build a qubit memory, that might be exciting.
Yeah, it seems like Yao and I think it was Potter, the gentleman from Texas, it seemed like they were really excited about the discovery that time crystals is just one manifestation of this new state of matter that allows them to exploit properties that otherwise wouldn't be physically achievable.
Oh, that very well may be. It would be nice if they could figure out a way to get around that stuff from Watanabe and Oshikawa, where, you know, this can't happen in a ground state. Because as it is, it doesn't have the rigidity of a crystal. I think about it a little bit like comparing a Moncala board to a crystal lattice, right? As long as you have that board sitting there, right? As long as you have those little dips there that have been provided for the rocks are going to stay in one spot, right? They're going to be nice and stable in that one spot. But as soon as you get rid of that Moncala board and you put those rocks on a flat surface and you start jiggling the surface around, those rocks are going to go wherever they want to go. And so it's not really stable. So, I mean, it's an interesting idea, and there are probably all sorts of interesting things you can do with it. You know, you really do want that original idea of Wilczek. I mean, if you really want a real state of matter, you want that idea from Wilczek, because then you have a piece of something that you put on your desk, and maybe it turns blue every 3 seconds. I don't know what it does. You know, you have this thing that's sort of a real thing. Now, maybe they'll be able to figure out how to do something using thermal fields. If you can find a way to use a random driving force to do this, right?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, is if we coupled this to phononics, where you could maybe just channel the direction and frequency of ordinary thermal vibrations as down a pipe, so that you'd end up with just a single frequency to stimulate the time crystal to keep it energized periodically, then maybe you'd have something.
That's completely possible. I just don't know how well it would work. That's something that would be interesting to figure out how to do, but you have to figure out how to do it on two ends now. You have to figure out both with the phonons and with the actual physical material. That would be a great thing to have happen. It's just trying to get a really nice coherent pulse that happens at a really well-defined time using random thermal vibrations is not something that, if I were an engineer, I would not want to try that.
Yeah, but this is another one of these little glimpses that we're seeing where physicists are getting to the point where they're just starting to engineer matter at a quantum level, you know, and maybe in some, I remember reading a little bit in about the topological insulators, how they were looking at engineering the wave function of the matter. So we're getting closer to that point where we're getting to like molecular engineering, where maybe this will all become possible.
That's what a lot of people are trying to do. I mean, this is just a really different way of doing something, but possibly somebody who's pretty clever and has the right patterning tools could do something with some topological insulator or some other nano-patterned material, some other metamaterial, to figure out how to make these things work.
Yeah, and this seems like the kind of people that'd be likely to get there first. These were both joint projects from some of the smartest people in the country working in this realm. You've got all the great physics institutions, you know, with the most cutting-edge research facilities getting together to perform these experiments. Let's see. Yeah, I mean, you've got Berkeley working with Harvard, and I didn't realize that the University of Maryland had this kind of cutting-edge research going on. So let's see. I don't understand. One of the things that came up was Floquet cycles. What are those? Are Floquet cycles?
Yeah, I'm not sure how you pronounce it. I'd say Floquet.
What are Floquet cycles? I didn't understand that.
In this case, they're just periodic Hamiltonians.
Oh, okay.
That's all it means. It means that you have, in these cases, you know, Yao had here's my pulse, I'm trying to flip everything. Then I let things relax using interactions and random disorder. Then I go back to my pulse again, and then I let things relax. And then I go back to my pulse, and I let things relax, and over and over and over again. And with the Lucan thing, so the Yao thing's like the Monroe thing. With the Lucan thing, what they're doing is they're just switching what the driving field is, right? So in that case, they're not turning off the disorder, and they're not turning off the dipolar interaction because they can't, right? Because they've got all of these different spins randomly positioned in a big piece of diamond. So all of that stuff is stuck there. What they're doing instead is they're just switching from a continuous wave to a pulse field. You know, you could have just a continuous wave thing. You could have just a pulse thing. But the Floquet cycle is, you know, I'm changing my Hamiltonian from the continuous wave to this pulse that's at some sort of angle from that continuous wave interaction. And that's pretty much all it is.
So what do you think of the applications for this kind of thing? I mean, where do you think they're going to go from here?
I have no idea what the applications are. They didn't have much in the stuff that you sent me, for example. You know, when they say things like these could form the basis of robust quantum memories or improved devices for precision measurement, they're just saying that because NSF isn't going to fund you if you say, I'm just doing this for fun.
Oh, I see. It could be precision measurement because the cycle of the system is so precise. Is that it?
Possibly. It's not really telling me what the idea is. And I think right now these are mostly interesting for their own sake. Trying to figure out something about what's going on with time translation. Translation symmetry is important too. I mean, that's where conservation of energy comes from. That could lead to some interesting things in how you can actually build interesting devices and crystals. What happens when I have these periodic driving functions? Maybe some interesting physics can come out of that, and if interesting enough physics comes out of that, they can build up some devices out of that later. But, I mean, at this point, I wouldn't be pushing for any real application. I'm sure somebody will figure something out. I shouldn't say that because there are lots of things where they never figured it out. You know, there were people that were going to do electronics with quarks 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And that never really turned into anything.
Yeah, a little hard to control quark glue on plasma at a technological level. But there was a quote from Potter in one of the pop articles that I read about this. It said the truly fascinating thing about these experiments is that they have the potential to suspend the laws of physics indefinitely, like a hot cup of coffee that never reaches room temperature. So apparently when it's subjected to this driving frequency, they're saying that, I guess that's because it doesn't thermally return to a random state. They're basically holding off entropy, right?
Can't say that. The whole reason why they have to have the periodic driving force is because they can't hold off the entropy.
Well, that's what I mean, though, is that if in this system, if you have that driving force, then he's saying that you're suspending the laws of physics while that's happening. But that's kind of like saying that if you have any periodic system and you're adding energy to it, it's going to keep going and not return to a, you know, an entropy condition, right?
If you're talking about entropy and you've got energy going in, you're out of luck, because if you've got energy going into the system, then can add entropy, you can lose entropy. That can all happen with your coupling to the exterior system, to the external world. It's not a big mystery. I mean, at some point, it all fails. It just depends on what you're defining as your system. At some point, you're going to have a system large enough that it's gaining entropy, and then every system larger than that will also be gaining entropy. So that doesn't work. There might be some interesting things where we can see effects before causes or something strange like that in these systems. That would be awesome. I think that's kind of more likely, is that you can see at sort of a nanoscale range, maybe. That would still be pretty amazing to be able to see it, that happen at a nanoscale time frame. But, you know, that's the sort of thing he might be talking about, because I didn't read it. I don't know.
Yeah, he didn't get too specific. He was speaking really general terms, so it was hard to see what he was envisioning. But there was another term that came up that I didn't understand. You might know better than they talked about many-body localization. What does that mean?
That has to do with the wave function and...
Oh, okay.
That's part of what the disorder term is doing, but I don't know enough about it. But that's part of the reason why they need the disorder term to cool things down, is that many-body localization.
Okay. I thought it was really cool to see the emergence of a brand new idea and physics come up, and then 4 years later have it in the lab, especially after all the controversy that was surrounding about whether it was going to be possible to detect this kind of behavior or not. So yeah, I thought it was a lot of fun to see physics in action and to see that kind of turnaround. You know, there's so many things in quantum theory and in relativity that took half a century or a century to observe. I think gravitational waves took almost a century to detect for the first time. And here's something that was predicted and realized within 4 years. I just thought that was really neat.
Well, yeah, that was a really quick turnaround time. I mean, even some of these things we failed to talk about when we tried to talk about them, like the quantum Hall effect. I mean, it took 20, 30 years to actually detect them. So it's very interesting that something like this is viable. I mean, it just happened right away. But again, it happened because, just like I was talking about, there are systems out there that are very similar to this. So
the labs were already kind of set up for this kind of thing.
It's not like a Bose-Einstein condensate, where before people could actually look at the Bose-Einstein condensate, they had to do 60 years or 80 years or however many years it was, probably 60.
Super cooling technology.
Yeah, of just figuring out how to cool things, figuring out how to laser cooling and all these other different strange things to get to these nanokelvin temperatures, just so they could see the Bose-Einstein condensate. Instead, it was something where you've got something that's actually close enough to something you could observe that you can make some predictions and see what actually happens, which is a little bit odd. I think that's really the big contribution with this Yao paper, is that he said, okay, you know, we can do some calculations and show that there are some traces of this that you can see that are different from what you'd expect to see in a spin echo, in nuclear magnetic resonance. Although, you know, again, it's just the same sort of idea. You know, the sort of Hamiltonian he's using, the sort of effects he's looking at are all things that are in just about any nuclear magnetic resonance experiment. So all you have to do is figure out how to do the same thing, look at these pulses and so forth, and then you're okay. But again, 20 years ago, they were getting to the point where they could make the sort of detectors to look at things oscillating at these timescales. So everything was already rolled out and ready for them when it came time.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing they can take these incredibly precise measurements at, you know, nanosecond timescales.
Oh yeah, that's fun.
Jesus.
Yeah, so, I mean, everything just happened to be ready for them technologically, and it sounds like Lucan had something available. I mean, I didn't read a whole lot about how he had to create that one piece of diamond, or that one sample of diamond.
Right.
So I'm assuming that it was something that if he didn't have it lying around the lab, he was able to go talk to somebody and they could make it for him in, you know, 25 minutes or something.
Here, give me a piece of coal. I'll have that for you by the time lunch is over.
Yeah, I don't remember how the... I've seen lectures on the different impurities in diamond, and the physics behind it is very interesting, how different impurities at different locations give you different color diamonds and stuff like that.
Yeah, these impurities were like 5 nanometers on average apart from each other.
Yeah, I did that calculation. I think that's about right. I don't know where it went. It was something like that. There were, it was something like that. I know I did the calculation, but I don't see the number through my notes, and I'm just going to sit here leafing through them and boring everybody.
Yeah, there's a crazy amount of numbers thrown at you in frequencies and all of this stuff in these papers. It's hard to remember everything, my God.
Well, yeah, but that's the interesting one for the Lucan paper, is how close are these things actually to each other? It's about 30 lattice spacings on average, is what I have written down. So I estimated that to be about 10 nanometers, but that was just sort of guessing the lattice spacing, because I don't know the lattice spacing of diamond off the top of my head. But that was from that 45 parts per million number that they gave us.
Yeah, and they needed to be that close because they needed a strong coupling between adjacent nitrogen voids, right?
Yeah, they need something with long-range dipolar interactions. So they probably want those to be close, but not too close. I'm not sure what the trade-offs are. And with these spins, if you get too close, they become ferromagnetic, I believe. So you want them to be far enough away, probably, that they're still dipolar, so that you're in a system where there isn't much exchange between them that's trying to align them. There's not a lot of wave function overlap between each one of those atoms. But instead, mostly their interaction is due to their magnetic fields, the magnetic fields generated by their spins.
I think somewhere in there they mentioned that if they had been too close, like within 3 nanometers, that there would have been like a quantum tunneling effect that would have disrupted their experiment.
I guess that could happen too. So yeah, I mean, you want them at some level like that. And I mean, personally, I'd just probably throw in a bunch of different diamond samples if I had a bunch of different diamond samples and see which worked. My wife would get mad at me because I'm supposed to calculate everything before I try it. But you know, sometimes the calculations take longer than the experiments.
Right. Looking at some of these calculations, I can believe it. Some of the math in here is pretty heady.
So did you have anything else with this that you wanted to talk about?
No, I thank you very much for taking the time to sort of sift out the time crystal fact from fiction, because there's a lot of misconceptions, I think, in the pop literature, and it's an interesting subject, and it was good to go over the nuts and bolts with you and flesh out the things that I'd never even heard of before and get at least some specious grasp on this principle.
It was fun. I'm glad to hear that there are more things that people are arguing about physics on the internet. Maybe we can find some more in the future.
We will.
All right. Talk to you later, Randy.
Thank you, Jim.